Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod, hosted by me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by broadcaster, writer and host of a number of excellent podcasts, such as Adrift with Annabella Port and Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband, Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
We're sitting in my loft and I'm trying to get a bit of an airflow through here, and the door just slammed as you were doing your introduction there. So I think I might close this one and then leave the skylights
it's
open.
Fine.
How's that?
It's lovely. I'll tell you what, this room, any Beatles fans coming here, I'm just admiring the Beatles in mono box set, the White Album box set. There's a lot of box sets here, and they're all Beatley.
There is, and there's a lot of books as well.
I know.
This podcast I do with Ed Miliband, that we did an episode on vegetarianism, and he was saying, do you think we could get Paul McCartney on? Because Paul's PR person had sent me, do you remember he did a short, but he's always sort of up to something, and he'd done a short video around climate change last year.
Yeah.
And so I'd been invited to a screening of that, and he said, can you get Paul to come on? And I've been lucky enough to interview McCartney a bunch of times in the past, but I thought we can't invite him here where we record the podcast, because it would be like that scene in Alan Partridge. He goes back to the fan's house and it's just too creepy.
Have you got a big tattoo of him on your chest?
it's a bit intense, isn't it?
So today we're talking about Anthology 2, oddly enough, the second in the Anthology series, released in 1996. And sort of taking you back to that time, I think from my perspective, all I remember about it was there were a lot of bootlegs coming out at the time, and you had the ultra rare tracks, artifacts, this sort of thing. And I'm sure that was probably the impetus in releasing this in the same way that the Red and the Blue albums with the Alpha Omega bootleg, because everybody had it. But what was your experience of this?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think, another reason they would have done the whole anthology project is, you know, George's losses due to his business partner in the film industry probably meant the bank account needed replenishing. And I remember hearing at the time, although I'm sure it was just tabloid stuff, that Ringo was down to his last 10 million.
So, I mean,
you never know what the real impetus behind these things is. But certainly at that time, and I know there were a lot of bootlegs in circulation, but it's difficult for people who are younger than we are to understand how inaccessible stuff was, because now you just go and look for something on YouTube, and sure, it gets taken down pretty quick a lot of the time. But this stuff, you'd have to go on hunts to try and find things. I used to go to the Corn Exchange in Manchester, and there'd be people selling the legit records and tapes and CDs, and then they'd have a box of bootlegs that you'd get, they'd get out for you underneath the desk. But I think there was a lot of stuff flying around, but it wasn't, for me anyway, that easy to find it. I think, maybe I only had, at the point the anthology came out, 4 or 5 bootleg CDs and some tapes that somebody had made for me. But I was in my early 20s at the time. So this was 96, Anthology 2, wasn't it? And the TV show was 95. So I would have been sort of 22, 23 at the time. And I'd not long since got into the Beatles. So I worked in local radio and stuff. And I think sort of everybody is into the Beatles, in as much as it's so much part of the culture, it's like nursery rhymes. Mm. So I remember singing When I'm 64 at school, and it just belonged with all those other songs like Row, Row, Row Your Boat and My Grandfather's Clock. It's part of just sort of wider culture at that point. And stuff like She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand, you'd still hear on the radio. Radio 1 even would still play stuff like that when they do the golden hours. Mm. But I'd never had the records growing up. My dad, with some pride, will tell me, I remember hearing Frank Ifield, I Remember You and Love Me Do on Radio Luxembourg the same night. And I thought, yeah, these two records are all right, but I was never really into the Beatles. I was a teddy boy. Yeah. And my mum thought, oh, I never thought they'd go anywhere. So yeah. They were never really, the records were never really part of my life growing up. My dad sort of only ever had singles. And some of them would be great. There'd be stuff like Elton John, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road in there, but there'd be some sort of horrendous things like, do you know, Honey by Bobby Goldsborough?
Oh, yeah.
It's like quite this slushy, awful sacrament. Like, there'd be a lot of... My dad loves a song that tells a story. I mean, yes. Yeah. There'd be
Deck
a lot of
cards.
Just, yeah, yes, it's like awful things like that in there. Hey Paula by Paul and Paula. Yeah. Just like these terrible, terrible records. So I didn't have any older siblings with a cool record collection, nor did I have parents who, despite living through the 60s, had particularly enjoyed the Beatles. You're like, yeah, I thought Lennon was all right. Yeah, you know, it'd be that's the kind of thing my dad would say, but generally pretty dismissive. So I was working in local radio in Stockport, and we would play you know, quite a lot of Beatles tracks. And then one day my boss, this guy Neil, had got the reissue of Plastic Ono Band when it first came out on CD, I'm guessing. And he said, have you ever heard this? I said, no. He said, go in the studio and listen to it. So I went into this tiny little booth.
What an introduction.
Yeah, and wow. I just sat. And honestly, I don't know how many hours I was in there for, but I just listened to it over and over and over and over again. So this had been sort of 93, 94. And then I just thought, okay, I've got to collect all the Beatles records. I've got to learn everything there is to learn about the Beatles. And then, you know, I'd get paid weekly back then, and then every week I'd go out and buy. Yeah. I'd started with Revolver, and then kind of work my way out in both directions, and just sort of became obsessive, and then started reading the books, and then by the time the anthology came along, and I'm thinking more of the TV show than the CDs, I was so ready to absorb all that information, and I feel like, you know, you're probably the same. I've got that documentary almost committed to memory.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the different lines. And if I hear Beatles songs, you know, often straight away I'll hear in my head, which, you know, what the various Beatles were saying about the songs at the time. I can amuse the only people in the slightest bit amused by this, and I won't do it now because it's not a good impersonation, but my in-laws, I can amuse them greatly by doing an impersonation of Paul McCartney. So give me a Beatles song and I will do them an impersonation of Paul McCartney telling them the story behind that song. And, you know, often it's, you know, just an amalgamation of different things, or guessing how he would do it. But yeah, it's funny that, I mean,
stories continue to this day, don't they?
Even the ones which sort of aren't 100% true or slightly misremembered. And I love that bit. I mean, sort of flying around all over the place here, but one thing that I thought was lovely about the end of the anthology was the four different perspectives. You know, John, we were just a band. Paul saying, well, the great thing is, you know, we were singing about peace and love, which is fine. and sort of George talking about how it kind of ruined his nervous system. And then Ringo very sort of simplistically saying we were just four guys who really loved each other. But I've got so much of it committed to memory like that. I remember watching it every week. And at the time I was living with this girlfriend who, you know, wasn't particularly interested in the Beatles. And by the time it got to actually the period which we're talking about today, you know, that golden sort of transitioning from Help into Rubber Soul and Revolver and Sgt. Pepper and Magical Mystery Tour. I mean, she was just sort of blown away, couldn't speak after that episode. Really? And then, you know, ended up getting it on VHS and DVDs. And it was that thing that, you know, when you're young and you go out and people pile back to yours afterwards, you'll put a record on, or I would put the anthology on, you know. I know we've kind of got it with the one compilation, but I know there'll be problems around different people owning the rights and stuff, but what I would like is some kind of streamable / Apple TV friendly thing where I could watch any Beatles song individually, that there is a performance or even like some kind of visual performance, like a Magical Mystery Tour or a Help performance. Wouldn't that be great? Just being able, instead of having to find your Help DVD and fast forward through to You're Gonna Lose That Girl or something, just to have them all in one place.
It's never been easy for Beatles fans. I remember back in, the 85, I think it was, when they were talking about releasing an album of outtakes in 1985, and they were talking about releasing Leave My Kitten Alone. And in the Beatles Monthly, which regularly got that was news each month. Yep, it's going to be coming out in August or whatever. And here's the single, here's the cover. Everything was so exciting. And then the following issue was, nah, it's not going to happen.
Because it was prepared, wasn't it? It was ready to go.
And as Beatles fans, we were let down again and again and again. And you know, they just released another compilation. And the BBC sessions obviously came out before this. And again, it was a bit sceptical. Yeah, I bet they won't. It'll be an album. They miss. But, whoa, hang on a minute. They've given us all of this.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And the anthology stories came out. And you think, are they going to do it? And yeah, they did. Really, didn't they, I guess.
It is a brilliant collection as well. I mean, I'm sure, like, what I would like ultimately, this is what I'd like if anyone from Apple is listening. I would like to be able to pay a premium and then go online and have access to every single studio tape and have a little console so that I can mix it myself.
Oh, absolutely.
So did you get the Jailbroken Beatles Rock Band files?
I did, yes.
I mean, so that's the closest we've got. I mean, and I will sit, it drives my wife to distraction. I'll sit there and say, right, just listen to just only the vocal and the harmonies from something. Or I'll just sort of put the bass on a song and the vocal and say, listen to this. And just hearing them breathe or hearing, actually with the vocals especially, that it's a bit raggedy. Because everything in pop music now is so perfect and produced. And the Beatles made the greatest records of all time. And if you're lucky enough to have access to these a cappellas, they're really sort of quite raggedy. The harmonies aren't spot on, but the overall effect is just magnificent. I mean, you know, they liked, didn't they? They liked their imperfections and mistakes and making that into stuff. And it is part of, you know, I don't think you can ever really decode what makes the Beatles magical, but it's definitely part of it.
John Morris was saying about it's all the found sound, it found stuff. So things like chairs creaking.
Halfway
through, a lot of it's been edited out now.
Yeah, which is a shame. Whenever I would play A Day on the Life on the radio, I refused, and it would drive my bosses mad, I would refuse to speak until after the chair creaks. Perfect. And you get the shush. So I had to go into a studio and make a version where that long note at the end was gained up so that the radio listeners didn't think it was dead air.
Yeah.
But I refused. You know, no, these people just giving it 10 seconds. It's not enough. You know, you've got to give it the respect it deserves.
Real Love. So Geoff Lynne had a lot of work on this. He had a tape, didn't he? Yoko sent him a tape. And I think he spent most of the time just removing. There was all sorts of spikes in it and hiss and hums before they could even touch it. Free as a Bird was more of a... Paul definitely enjoyed it because they actually composed part of the song, but this was purely them performing a Lennon song.
So Free as a Bird wasn't a song that I never had that on a bootleg. And then I heard talk of, oh yeah, we got this song and it's unfinished. So the great thing is I can write, you know. So I thought, oh, what's he going to write? And then you listen, you eventually get your hand on the John Lennon bootleg. And he sort of wrote half a line. Lennon goes, what happened to the life that we once knew. So Paul just writes, you know, can we really live with it? Great line and all that, but slightly. I think the other thing, I know we're jumping onto Anthology One, but the thing that, and I did like Free as a Bird, I mean, I'm fairly uncritical. I will find merit in pretty much everything that has ever had the Beatles' name on it, apart from Piggies, for some reason. Okay. But I really disliked the way that you've got that little bridge. Paul sings it the first time round and George sings it the second time round. I thought they would never have done that. Wouldn't.
No.
And, it, you know, I understand why they did it. And I understand the politics in that studio at the time must have been quite something. But I felt a bit disappointed by that. And, you know, I like Real Love. It's an interesting one because, you know, sometimes as a bit of I mean, it's not trivia because it's opinion, but opinion masquerading as trivia. I'll say to people, what is the one Beatle cover version that is better than the original? And, you know, people might throw at me Wilson Pickett's Hey Jude. And I say, no, absolutely not. It's Regina Spektor doing Real Love. That, you know, because in my mind, the, you know, no version of any Beatles song is better than the Beatles version. But I think I'll allow it with this one. So I re-listened to it this morning and I do like it. I know the thing that everybody moaned about at the time, and I think it's a valid criticism, is the drums just sound like ELO.
The whole thing does, doesn't it?
It does, and it's over the years I've softened towards ELO. You know, I think I'm of an age where ELO, what a load of old shit. You know, the only good music in the 70s was punk music, and I kind of mellowed with time, and I do like a lot of ELO stuff now. But is this Beatles obsessive trying to make a Beatles, you know, a Beatles-y Magical Mystery Tour Pepper era sound? And it's the drums especially that sound like pastiche. You've got Ringo Starr sounding like somebody not doing the greatest Ringo Starr impersonation. And it's a shame. I just think he's such a brilliant drummer, and he always serves the song in such the perfect way. He never overplays his hand. And yet on this, it does sound a bit like a Beatles tribute band, and it's I don't even understand how you get kind of Ringo to sound not like Ringo. And then I think another thing with it, and I have said that I really love it, so and you know, like the harmonies, for example, I think are fantastic on it. You've got George's signature slide guitar, which I think is used better actually on Free as a Bird than it is on Real Love. There's something about Real Love that doesn't... There's a cohesiveness to Free as a Bird that I don't think is quite there on Real Love. It feels like these separate bits than it does, more than it does a whole, which is understandable. I'm fascinated by this idea of Paul talking about how, you know, he would double up on the vocals to give John's vocal a bit of strength. And he, you know, he said at some point, yeah, I can do a pretty passable Lennon. So I would love to hear just Paul's vocal tracks.
Yeah.
Like Paul McCartney doing A Stars in Your Eyes, John Lennon.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah. And the you know, I liked the video to this not as much as the Free as a Bird one. I thought the Free as a Bird one was really classy. And this was slightly less so. And there is that moment, which is, hey, one of the most uncomfortable moments ever committed to film, of George and Ringo and George in Paul's studio swaying and singing along. And George looks like he wants to die. Ringo's having a lovely time. Paul is hamming up for the camera. And George is, you can just see in his face, make it stop. Please make it stop.
He did. I think purely by virtue of Jeff Lynne producing this, he had a lot of input into the whole thing. During the Hey Jude, there was a huge argument about, because originally he wanted to echo Paul's vocal on the guitar, and Paul was like, no, big arguments that went on into the Let It Be film as well. He's doing it on this. So like, all the little girls and boys.
Yeah.
And he's got free reign.
And he shouldn't have.
No.
No, dial it back a bit.
He should. Yeah, so the politics and dynamics of the band. It's all very...
The thing about George Martin not being involved is very interesting to me. So it seems like that was George's bargaining chip. Yeah. Jeff Lynne's going to do it. And I know George Martin's hearing was you know, on the decline, but it was still good enough to kind of do the rest of the anthology and the Love album with Giles. So you can't help but suspect there was sort of more internal politics and wrangling. Not that I think it would be a slight against George Martin, but just more you know, balancing the power dynamic against Paul in the studio, perhaps.
Yeah.
I met George Martin. I only met George Martin once. And it was at the Martin Scorsese Living in the Material World documentary. And I know Giles a little bit from having had him as a guest on the radio show, but I'd never met his dad. And Giles said, oh, you've got to come over and meet my dad. And I had been trying to buy some chocolate Olivers.
Okay. Of course.
Which were the Beatles' favourite biscuits.
Yeah.
And I think Lennon once made a joke about being paid in chocolate Olivers for a... for a gig, and I think he would have them sent over to New York. And Giles had told me at some point in the past that his dad used to send chocolate Olivers to John in New York periodically. So I tried to buy some from, you know, the posh department store in London, Fortnum and Mason, and it was a really hot summer. And due to the way their factory was set up, they couldn't make chocolate Olivers because the temperatures were too high. Yeah. So I thought, I'll tell George Martin about this. So I told him, you know, in truncated form, what I've just told you. And he was very smiley, but I could tell that he's thinking, why are you telling me this? Oh. And I felt a bit embarrassed. And then Giles said to me afterwards, you know, my dad would have loved that story, but he's too deaf to be able to hear what you're saying now. Yeah. But it was, you know, great to meet George Martin. Oh. That was one to tick off.
Very tall, isn't he?
Yeah.
I met him once at Abbey Road. We were in a band at the time, and we had a demo. We were desperate. So somebody had the bright idea of phone EMI and to say, oh, can I speak to George Martin? No, he's not in. He's in tomorrow. Cool. So we all headed off there. Well, me and a friend headed off there with our demo tape, waited outside in the rain, and he pulled it. That's really dodgy, but anyway, he pulled up in his Rolls Royce, and his wife, is it Judy, his wife?
Yeah.
And they came out, Miss Martin, got him to come over, got him to autograph a book, which handily we had, and then gave him this tape, and he said, oh, no, I'm a dinosaur now, I won't be doing this.
Right.
And bless her, she was saying, oh, just put it in your pocket, George, just, you know, appease him. And I know as soon as they went, he would have thrown it away.
But yeah.
He knew that we saw him put it in his pocket. But
what a gentleman. Oh, I just love him. I mean, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because we're here for the music, really. But just the story and the characters in the story. And they were so fortunate with the people. I think it's Mark Lewis, and, you know, uses the analogy of lightning striking twice in the sun, then three times in the same place and four times. It's just the luck they had in so many different ways, the way things converged, and that included the people they got to work with.
Yeah.
Just brilliant, brilliant man.
If you were red tonight, remember what I said tonight. For red is the color that my baby wore, and what's more, it's true. Yes, it is.
The next seven songs are all from Help or Help era.
Yeah, and I know people who aren't big Beatles fans, but they're music fans, and their take on the Beatles can often be, it didn't really kick in till Rubber Soul did, and it absolutely kicked in. I mean, You've Got to Hide Your Love Away was on Help. I mean, Help itself, Ticket to Ride, the drumming on that, so many great things. You know, I as I said before, I fairly much love everything the Beatles have ever put their name to. And I love those first four albums. But if you do want to kind of draw a line and say, okay, here's the point at which it became supercharged, I think there's a good argument for making that point Help rather than Rubber Soul.
Mm.
So the first thing we've got is Yes, It Is.
Yes, It Is.
Oh, I love that song. I mean, I'm amazed that John Lennon didn't really have any time for it. He thought it was just a knockoff of This Boy, didn't he? Which, I mean, he wrote it, so he knows what he was doing. But, you know, if it is a knockoff of This Boy, it's a really successful one. The finished version, the harmonies are just sublime. But on this version, it's one of those ones where you hear the fragility in John's voice. Mm. And it's so beautiful. And as we all know, as they spent more time in the studio, he became obsessive about disguising his voice because he grew to hate it. But it's just amazing when it's sort of little like this. Yeah. On one of the BBC albums, I think there's that version of To Know Her Is to Love Her.
Yes.
And I think there's a really similar quality in that to this version of Yes, It Is. And I love, I'm not musical particularly, so I don't know what's going on with the guitars. It's some kind of volume pedal though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit like a wah-wah kind of thing, but it's just wah, wah.
Yeah. I love that sound too. I think it's a fantastic, a slight bugbear of mine, and I can see why they did it, is with the anthology albums, they felt the need to sort of fade in more perfect takes towards the end. And Yes It Is one of these. So I would have been happy really for a complete take of John just singing this lead vocal, but George Martin made the decision, okay, let's have how it ended up with the smothered in harmonies at the end. And they're beautiful harmonies. It's one of their great performances in that sense. But I guess what they were doing is making it more palatable. Because I'd been fired off the radio at the time these CDs came out. Oh. And I was working in a record shop.
Right.
And a lot of people were just buying them as if it was the best of the Beatles or some new form of the best of the Beatles.
Yeah.
So I guess they had one eye on that type of record buyer and wanted some of these things to sound a bit more polished than they were. And you also get the sense as well from reading interviews with the Beatles that they were kind of baffled that people would want to hear this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, and we die for it, people like you and I. But to them, here's the stuff we didn't get right.
Yes.
Yeah.
With Britpop, a lot of people would have been introduced to Beatles by Oasis and all these bands citing the Beatles. So the anthologies possibly could be their introduction.
Yeah.
So they're hearing Real Love. Oh, okay, well, that's them reformed. Right, let's hear them as an original band. And it's John. They're not very enthusiastic, are they? So it'd have been a strange introduction.
Yeah. So the record shop I was working was also a musical instrument shop. So, pretty much everyone who worked there apart from me was a musician. And you know, they would be really into listening to these takes and figuring out how they did it and stuff. and, you know, these were, you know, a lot of them lads who were really into what was going on with Britpop at the time.
You tell lightning and I can see. You can't.
I'm down. This is take one.
Yeah.
So no backing vocals, no organ.
Well, that's the great thing about this version is you get to be the karaoke backing vocalist.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I like I'm Down. I loved seeing the Shea Stadium performance of it. It's one of the great
John's
bits.
Hilarious.
Yeah. And just the sweat. And it is what... last year or year before when the Ron Howard thing came out, I was... visiting my wife's family in Chicago at the time. So we went to the pictures to see it. And it was great because there was a queue around the block.
Really?
Yeah, that's yeah. Bad. And they got an organist. It was an old cinema. They got an organist playing Beatles songs. And then they showed Shea Stadium afterwards. And we'll probably talk a little bit about Shea Stadium later because it crops up on the anthology. But yeah, I'm down, especially the sweat.
Yeah,
on their faces, and the that's one of those performances where you get a hint of what it must have been like to be there.
Yeah,
but I like I'm Down. It is pastiche, but it's good pastiche. Always good to hear Paul doing his Little Richard thing, isn't it?
Here I stand, head in hand, turn my face to the wall. If she's gone, I can't go on feeling. But small. Everywhere people stare, each and every day. I can see them laugh at me, and I hear them say.
Again, we were talking about the sections in the film. All I hear on this is Paul's broken a glass, broken a glass.
Yeah.
That's all I think of when I see the title of this.
Yeah. It's a funny one, isn't it? Hearing how they are in the studio. Like, I mean, I would buy an album of just them talking to each other in the studio.
Yeah.
Like, if I could get... Because there was a quarter inch running, I think, most of the time, after a certain point. And I would just... I'd pay money to just hear those bits of conversations as boring. Like when they brought out the White Album stuff last year and you hear George talking about how they should do Marmite flavoured crisps.
Yeah.
Oh, this is great.
It's gold.
Is, yeah. And that he's sort of thinking, we should write to them. this idea that the all powerful Beatles, we get what we're. And you hear it a little bit, I think, you know, McCartney in later years talks about, well, no one's Beatle-proof. So he'll meet these world leaders like Putin and think, expecting just because they're meeting a Beatle, it might change their minds about things. And you see like a bit of that in George saying, yeah, we should write to Golden Wonder and tell them they should do Marmite crisps. But on the Paul's Broken a Glass, I can't remember. It might be I'm Down Even. You've got Paul in a sort of a American accent at the beginning saying this is going to knock you out. This is going to be something. And it's for me, there's like a real insight in those little moments into their Lennon and McCartney particular personalities. And I think John, in any circumstance, can't help but be himself. It's just spills out of him. With Paul, I'm sure it's not like if you're having dinner with him or your family. I think there is always, even here, a slight, amongst the other Beatles in this working environment, which is, you know, their professional home, I think there's a slight turning it on when a microphone or a camera goes on. Even in this environment, it's only slight. And I don't know if it's defensiveness, slightly, you know, it's almost like he wants to impress. He always wants to impress even the other Beatles, but is that born out of an insecurity that he thinks he doesn't? I mean, it's fascinating to me. I mean, I won't dwell too much on trying to psychoanalyze but different Beatles.
To this day, as soon as you see a camera on him, his eyebrows go up. And
I don't know. It's not that he's fake or phony at all. It's just some people.
Yeah.
And my wife is like this. You know, if a camera's on her, she can't help but just be natural. She's very consistent always. Whereas even having been on radio for like 20-odd years and bits of telly or whatever, I still find like I'm being a version of myself. I'm being natural, but it's a version of myself. And I think it's almost like a mental gender. You're either one or the other. And Lennon was one, and McCartney was the other. Another example of them each bringing something that the other didn't.
Next we have, If You've Got Trouble. What are your thoughts on this little trinket?
I mean, sort of backing track-wise, I wonder if it belongs in the same box as maybe something like Run For Your Life. You can hear that they can, you know, motor along as a band to a certain extent. But look, I find it somewhat astonishing in a way, in as much as like the Beatles... Well, I mean, they'd incorporate mistakes and there's this raggediness to them. But one of the things about them was their impeccable taste. And it's like they didn't want to embarrass themselves. Mm. And yet, like, they'd give Ringo vocal spots on records.
Yeah.
And I think I love some songs with Ringo singing on them. You know, I've got a soft spot for With a Little Help from My Friends or Good Night, and you know, Yellow Submarine is what it is, and I love the way they all rally around him on Octopus's Guard. I mean, I could talk Honey Don't, I love, but Ringo's voice doesn't belong on a record in a certain way. So I went to the George Harrison tribute thing at the Albert Hall, which was, you know, one of the nights of my life, and Ringo came on, and it was moving. He sang Photograph, and that was moving. Wow. But you know, watching him on a stage, you can have a real sliding doors moment, and I'm not really talking about his drumming here, because I have a completely different opinion of his drumming. But you have a sort of sliding doors thing in your head where you think, oh, you could be a man in a pub. Like, you could be a man singing karaoke in a pub in Liverpool, and it wouldn't look much different to this, the kind of pointy fingers.
Yeah.
And there's just something surprising to me. And I know he was this, I mean, star is overstating it, but I know he was a big deal in Rory Storm, and he got his solo spot in that, and they had this respect for him. But I'm constantly surprised, really, that that respect extended to giving him a vocal on something which wasn't, you know, a bit silly like Yellow Submarine.
But then they gave Pete Best a vocal.
Yeah,
didn't they? So it was sort of like them expressing themselves as We Are Four.
Yeah, although I can understand it more on a stage, especially, you know, if they're doing Hamburg and they just want to break, they just want to fill the time. But once you get into the studio... you know, I don't think Pete Best got any vocals at the Decca
sessions. Well, he wasn't on the Decca tapes, was he? So, yeah. And actually, he's not got a bad voice.
Is that right? I don't know that I've ever heard Pete Best.
They released an album, Best of the Beatles.
Of course they did, yeah. I was in Liverpool the other... I do this show for Sirius Radio in the States on the official Beatles channel. And so it's called Get Back the Beatles in Britain, and I get to go to you know, talk to lots of brilliant people who are Beatles fans, but also go to locations with Beatley significance. And I was in Liverpool last week or the other week at the Magical, I think it's called the Magical Beatles Museum, and it's Rogue Best, who is the much younger brother of Pete Best and son of Neil Aspinall.
Neil Aspinall, yeah.
And he's opened this museum. I mean, it's... I loved it. You would love it. I mean, there are things in there that if you're just an American tourist turning up in Liverpool, you might think, why is this in a case? Mm. Whereas you or I think, oh, it's an actual carrier bag from the Apple boutique, you know? So it's got a touch of that to it. But he was telling me that he's got this deal with Pete Best that once a month, Pete will just go for a wander around the museum while it's open.
Wow.
So that you'd be there and you stand a chance of bumping into him. And he was saying Pete is having fairly much a year off. He does a lot of conventions and things, but he's having fairly much a year off this year. But he is he's committed to just going and wandering around that museum once a month, which is, I mean, it's such an odd thing, really, isn't it? Just like saying to your brother, would you mind just for half an hour just wandering around looking at these old things that you once owned?
But, bizarre.
Rogue was really interesting. Like, I love... here's another character that I think Mark Lewisohn's tune-in has gone some way to redressing it, but... I think Mona Best is a character who's not talked about enough in Beatles history, actually. She is a fascinating woman and, like, really pushing them at one stage and like, de facto manager. And certainly early on, there aren't many sort of female characters in the story. There's Mimi, I guess, but certainly in terms of strong and not just Beatles girlfriends and stuff. And Mona Best to me is fascinating.
Yeah, definitely.
She won this money on the... So she was married, I think, to a boxing promoter.
Right.
And I think he was somewhat of a ne'er-do-well. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to buy a house and, you know, but she wanted her name to be on the mortgage. And she won money on the horses and she was able to buy this house in the suburbs of Liverpool. And it's a... I mean, you want to see this place. I'd read about the Caspar.
Because they painted it, didn't they?
Yeah, but I didn't envisage... It's like this... If this house was in London, it would be worth £12 million.
Really?
It's like one of the big grand houses you would get in St John's Wood or Kensington or somewhere. And Mona Best bought this house and it was her name on the mortgage, and she had this idea for her son Pete to open this coffee club in the cellar, and it's amazing to go there actually and see it. You know, you can read about these things in the books as we all have, but when you see them, it contextualizes it in a whole different way. Like, it's this leafy posh street in Liverpool, and then all of a sudden, like, for you wouldn't expect there to be gaggles of teenagers on there, and you know, they're all there in the basement hanging out on a Saturday night. It's brilliant. I really recommend, you know, the museum if you're a real Beatles fan, and the Caspar just to see it and see the, you know, the ceilings that they painted and how small the stage area was.
So move on to a very big production piece, That Means a Lot, which almost sounds like a Phil Spector production in some respects.
Yeah, it does. It's also got... I can't put my finger on who, really. Like I thought Roy Orbison, but not really. But there's a style of early 60s solo singer record with too much reverb. Because that's what's going on here, really, isn't it? Yeah. It's too much reverb.
Oh, yeah.
But it's that for me is sort of what makes it interesting. And also the words they choose to harmonize on. It's not a good song particularly, and some of the lyrics are abysmal. Mm. Is it like sometimes things are fine, sometimes they're not? But yeah. It's something along those
that
lines.
Means a lot.
Yeah. But I do like the fact that they try drenching something in reverb and then never do that again.
Yeah.
That's what's interesting to me about it, because they, you know, they're trying all these things and usually they work their way through them and you get an end product. But with this, it's something they tried and then binned. Mm. And, you know, the melody's sort of fine.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's more interesting, again, on bootlegs that have come out. There's some alternate takes of this, and you can hear them trying different rhythms, different keys. They were just messing around with it in real time. Yep, there we go. That's the one.
That's what's great.
You're always right.
I mean, this is the thing. There's only one instance in the whole of the anthology, I think, and it's, you know, I think a lot of people would disagree with me. I think there's only one example of the version on the anthology being better than the release version, which I would have as While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I can really do without the noodling. I mean, you know, if I'd never heard the other version, I'd think the noodling version was sublime. Yeah. But it's so beautiful, just George and the acoustic guitar. Yeah. And then the version that they put out on Love with the Orchestration, I thought was great as well. Okay. You didn't like that. You thought, because that would have been maybe like the last thing George Martin
probably
would have orchestrated.
Was. Yeah.
I can't believe you're saying that about him.
I just felt it was, I don't know.
A bit saccharine.
I don't know. It was, I don't know, because I've heard the George acoustic version so many times, again from the bootleg years when it came out on an anthology, and the ending they looped because it had a brilliant ending.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's just let's hear that back,
right? Yeah,
which is lovely because it breaks all this poignancy, and yeah, I don't know. It was.
I've got a soft spot for Love because I was on late night radio at the time. And EMI got in touch and said, do you want the first play of Love before it comes out? So I played the whole thing in its entirety and it became this event and, you know, really overhyped it up. It's the first new Beatles album in, you know, however 10 years would it have been, 12 years, whatever it would have been. And sort of in the build up to it, got people talking about their memories of hearing the Beatles for the first time and then really, okay, here we go. We're going to hear it all together. And it was just exciting, and it got this great response from listeners. And it probably was, you know, I probably overhyped it for what it was because it was nothing we hadn't heard before in a certain way. But I just got fond memories and of interviewing Giles around that time as well. Yeah. It just felt like a bit of an event. So I have got a soft spot for Love, not to the extent that I think I could sit through Cirque du Soleil, though.
Yeah.
Much as the Beatles enjoy that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I'm just going to completely backtrack what I said. I love the George Harrison, George Martin version. I'm thinking of Grow Old With Me.
Oh, right.
When they did that, I'm getting the two mixed
so
up.
So I've not heard them doing Grow Old With Me.
That was a John song, but they got George Martin to do an orchestra.
Okay,
a string quartet
over top of that. I'm now thinking of, did they have a crack? Because the anthologies were each supposed to start with a new Beatles song. Didn't they take Grow Old With Me into the studio? Was it another song?
There was Now and Then.
And there's a thing on YouTube which purports to be, but it's not, is it? Yeah,
it's not them. And there's All For Love. And I don't think that, I think they played it and they didn't bother with it. But yeah, that thing on YouTube is just some guy in his
studio. Yeah, it sounds like some guy.
Sampling.
Yeah.
I know that backing vocal.
I wonder why. I'm surprised Paul hasn't gone back now that George is no longer around. And I'm guessing it's something to do with the democracy that is the Beatles. But I'm surprised Paul hasn't gone back to that thing.
Mm. I think Mark Lewison mentioned that, didn't he, about the George Harrison estate. They've under very specific orders, under his bequest, what will and won't come out. So I'm not sure.
So what would there be theoretically to stop Paul saying to Yoko, can I have that demo again and do it as a Lennon and McCartney thing?
Don't know. It'd be nice.
Yeah.
It'd be nice.
It would be nice. Because he sort of, He's a funny one, isn't he? The way that he will allude to these things when he's got a record out. You know, somebody will ask him about Carnival of Light. He's like, oh, yeah, I'd really like to get that out. I mean, I want to hear Carnival of Light once.
Yeah.
Once will be enough for me.
Yeah.
I mean, from what I understand, it makes Revolution 9 look like He Loves You.
Yeah, yeah. So. There's Barry Miles, I think, has described it best. And he'll literally like tell you from the start, and you've got them shouting Barcelona.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it sounds to me, from the descriptions I've read, if you see Magical Mystery Tour, Jesse's Dream with the spaghetti, I reckon it's going to be something like that, possibly.
Yeah.
Just this sort of...
For 28 minutes.
Yeah.
My son is obsessed with Magical Mystery Tour at the moment. He's only three.
Oh, wow.
And I've been sort of trying to indoctrinate him on the Beatles. And he's fascinated by vehicles. So I thought, oh, okay. So we got a yellow submarine. Bus. So he calls that Beatles boat. And then Drive My Car. He likes the horns in that. And I've got him. Penny Lane has a fire engine in it, which he likes.
Yeah.
And then Magical Mystery Tour. So I'll often put that on for him. And he really loves the scene with the coach going round and round airfield and the cars chasing it. He'll watch that over and over again. And when I'm watching that, I'm like looking at it, and it is Ringo driving that bus. And it looks like, I think these days you would just not get the insurance to make a film with somebody of, you know, Ringo's worth, like driving a bunch of members of the public around the track.
In the back.
Yeah, and it's like tilting. You think this could easily go over. But yeah, he really loves that. And so he's at a stage now where he'll leave it on past the race and we get into the flying bit with the Icelandic, footage. And then I Am the Walrus he's really into as well. So I'm
I would have been terrified as a kid watching
that. No, he really loves Goo Goo Batube, and he really likes Unpass to Get Me Jumper. So he's really into that.
It'll be an F for you. Yesterday I'm in G, but it'll be an F. It goes E minor to A seventh to D minor. Ready? Okay, man.
Moving on to Yesterday.
Yeah.
Take One. And it's, again, picking up from this, at the beginning you can hear George Harrison asking Paul, so what key is this in?
Yeah.
And they're just sort of chatting. And you think, does George think he's going to be playing on this song? I don't know. And because Paul said, oh, it's in this key. I'll show you in a minute. And then plays the whole thing through.
Their relationship, that band's relationship with this song would be worthy of a book in its own right.
Yeah.
I think, because it is like, I know often when people talk about Yesterday, I say, oh, I've heard it too many times. I can't hear it. But I think you can go to it and you can hear that it's magical, especially this, when you think a recording of it didn't exist and here it is coming into being. And, you know, Paul is talking through what the chords are. But then, you know, I think in the anthology he sort of talks about being a bit self-deprecating, like, well, you know, we're a rock and roll band and I was a bit embarrassed. But I do think he was a bit embarrassed. I do think, you know, as a band, you know, I think there's some quote from much later where George talks about Paul thinking he's Mozart because he wrote Yesterday, and then in the 70s getting under Lennon's skin that he'll be eating in a restaurant and, you know, they'll have a band or playing Yesterday or the Pipes musical play. Yesterday. And I think they understood that this thing was really special, but something about it really irked them as well. And then Paul, because he's this pleaser, but he's also, you know, so confident of his own abilities. Yeah. That's like the conflict with Paul, isn't it? He really wants to please, but he really knows his own mind at the same time, and he's trying to stop himself annoying them, but he thinks, no, I'm fucking great. You know, he knows that somewhere underneath as well.
And rightly so.
Yeah, rightly so. Yeah. But even a bit later on this, actually, we hear them at Blackpool on the TV show, and Paul plays Yesterday for the first time on British TV, and George sort of introduces it with the, I don't think he's snarky actually saying tonight opportunity knocks for Paul McCartney of Liverpool. I think that is fine. But then John's thanks Ringo at the end. I think it's perfect, but I think it's undermining.
Yeah.
And I think they just had this weird relationship with this song. I think they understood what it was, but something about it just sat slightly strangely with them.
It must be weird. From day one, they've been this four individuals in this huge band, and then suddenly, oh, yeah, we'll just have Paul on this one. You can kind of picture them in the studio, just sort of maybe glancing at each other. And yeah. Paul must have felt awkward as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. But it's that thing again. Like, I think at this point in the band, John could have still stamped his feet if he wanted to. But they, you know, they always knew what was best for the song. And the string arrangement, I think, is so tasteful.
Mm. Yes.
On it. It serves the song perfectly. Yeah. And it's weird hearing this version, actually, without it being there, because your head fills in the gaps. You can hear the way the strings...
It's Only Love. I've been trying to look through these songs as possible contenders that could be better than the original. I'd say possibly this, almost, but...
Yeah, I tell you what this song always makes me think. It sounds to me like the Ruttles.
Yeah.
It sounds like a sort of a brilliant pastiche of a Beatles song from this era more than it does the Beatles. But I like John's voice on it. I know it's not always thought of as everybody's favourite. I can't remember where the version where the vocal tape breaks down is. Is it? It's not on here.
No.
Do they maybe play it over the credits of one of the episodes of the anthology?
I think yes, they do.
Yeah. I was looking for that earlier and I couldn't find it. But yeah. I like it when his voice tears.
Yes.
A little bit.
Yeah.
You know. I think that's what I like about this record. And you know, the melody is. I don't want to call it mid Beatles by numbers because that you know undersells it a little bit, but it's a sort of very good version of a Beatles melody whilst simultaneously being a pretty, you know, unremarkable song in the grand scheme of things.
One thing I remember when I first heard this, because the first album I got was Sgt. Pepper, the chords to this are the same as the chords almost to Benefit of Mr. Kite.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You notice those things every now and again. Here, There, and Everywhere and Dear Prudence are very similar,
yes,
aren't they?
Yeah. Oh, no imagination, those boys, at all.
That's just a thing, actually. You know, we mentioned Yes, It Is before. Like, the Beatles were amazing plagiarists, really, because they'd magpie from all over the place, but then feed it through, you know, the prism of the Beatles, and it would come out sounding like this whole other thing.
Yeah.
You know, and just the way they'd be able to plagiarise a song like Watch Your Step over and over again. But they didn't like to be self-plagiarists. I think that's what John didn't like about, which that's an interesting thing to me, that they were happy to kind of take from elsewhere, but they didn't want to repeat themselves. Baby's good to me, you know, she's happy, ask me, you know, she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine.
Next four songs are from the Blackpool Night Out, which we were just talking about. So it's I Feel Fine, Ticket to Ride, Yesterday, and Help. And yeah, they are a light entertainment band, aren't they, at this point? And that you can feel that they've already outgrown this particular format.
Yeah, it's I looked up who else was on Blackpool Night Out, and it was hosted by Mike and Bernie Winters.
I prefer Mike and Bernie
Winters. And Lionel Blair was one of the other guests. This is pinnacle of light entertainment, isn't it? But
yeah.
Listening back to these, I was surprised, and not exclusively, but I was surprised how well they were playing.
Yes,
actually, because it you know, we were not into 66 at this point; we're still in 65, so it's not the worst. But they've lost. It's not what it was playing live for them. But they're still able to knock out pretty good versions. Their harmonies are strong. Ringo's drumming is good. I mean, I don't notice too many muff notes and stuff on them. So that was what was surprising to me about hearing these versions, actually, because you tend to think by the time the Beatles are getting into this era, they're a sloppy live band because they only ever would rehearse for a day. Mm. And then it's not like when they're playing the Cavern or Hamburg where they were doing it so much they were just, you know, at this other level. But yeah, I mean, I wonder if knowing it was their only UK TV performance and knowing that they'd got help to sell, that focused the minds and they thought we're going to, you know, put a bit of effort into this. I think they're pretty good versions, all of those.
Yeah.
In contrast, actually, with as you get further along the album. Yeah, when you get into, the Budokan especially.
Oh, yeah, they just don't want to be there, do they?
No. So, I thought these are... It was good to hear these again. I thought they're pretty good vocals.
I love it. I don't think I've ever heard a live version of Help where John hasn't fluffed the vocals, so every single time. Yeah. When I was, But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
The thing that, we can all sit here thinking, oh, here's something I wish existed. I wish a John Lennon doing Help Slowly existed, you know.
There is a demo.
Is there really? Because I've looked on
70s.
YouTube. Oh, okay.
And it's a bit whiny, to
right?
Be honest.
Yeah,
because originally it was.
I mean,
that.
Like as it was conceived. I don't know if he sort of did anything on a tape recorder at Kenwood. If so, I've never heard of it. But
I'm sure there was a lot of stuff at Kenwood that got lost.
Yeah.
Anyway. But yeah, he did one in the '70s, and I think he did a lot of that kind of stuff in the '70s, and it's very.
Yeah, some of it I think works. Like I really like. I mean, it's. I guess you'd say it's too slow, but his version of "Be My Baby." Which is our, I don't know if it's a rock and roll outtake, but it's on one of those anthology, Lennon anthology box set discs. And I like the sort of yearning on that. I mean, it's always exciting to think, oh, I'm going to hear a Beatle do one of the songs that fed their brain. And I think that is a great version of that. I didn't realize, is another one, when Tune In came out and, you know, Mark Lewisohn had really sort of meticulously researched set lists. I didn't realize that for a while they did a version of the Shirelles' Will You Love Me Tomorrow.
Mm.
Now, that is a song I would love to hear them doing.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it doesn't exist anywhere and never will.
He was, again, in an interview, he was saying there's a lot of stuff purported to be out there, but it's never emerged.
Yeah. And do you not just think it at this point, unless somebody has accidentally got... Like, I don't believe that anybody is sitting on anything of any great significance.
I don't know, but then things like that It's For You demo appeared
when
Cilla Black died, and she'd just been sitting on that. And
I guess I'm less talking about, you know, I think the Beatles are sitting on a bunch of stuff, you know, as Giles Martin talked about when he went into Friar Park to, you know, do the Find the Isha demos. Like George obviously had they all have got a bunch of stuff. But what I mean is I don't know if I buy into this idea that somebody in Liverpool is sitting with, you know, somebody who knew a Corrie man is sitting with something in his attic and he's just waiting for the right offer. I don't know that there's many of those things out there, really.
I think with the advent of the internet, everything that is out there is out there that we wouldn't know about.
Yeah. Well, he took some honey from a tree, dressed it up and they called it.
So moving on from the Blackpool night out, now we suddenly move on to Shea Stadium.
Yes.
And again, yeah, as I was saying, like Blackpool, that light entertainment format, which they clearly outgrown, and this is the result.
Yeah, it is, and it's got, you know, it's a he loves his Carl Perkins. I always love the fact that when they did that Scottish tour and gave themselves pseudonyms, he called himself Carl Harrison.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the least glamour, like switching out George for Carl. Like, at least Paul went with Ramon and you know, John Lennon was Long John Silver at different
Stairs,
stage. Yeah, but just Carl, it's the most ordinary name. But yeah, I tell you what is interesting to me about this is I would love to know when you see the Shea Stadium footage. I'd like actually be able to separate out what was Shea Stadium and what was when they came back to London and realised it was terrible.
Yeah,
because this to me, I mean this cannot be a re-recording because he's off mic a lot of the time. It's quite scrappy.
Yeah,
and then when you watch the Shea Stadium film, some of the songs, you know, they've made an effort to make it sound like a live performance.
Yeah, but it sounds like they're in a barn.
Yeah, yeah. That's the weird thing. I mean, you wonder how bad they must have been at Shea Stadium. Yeah. I think, like, what an experience. What a, you know, cultural high point of the 20th century. But in terms of what was coming out of those speakers, thank God nobody could hear it, because I bet it was pretty awful.
Well, they probably couldn't.
No, I mean, you definitely couldn't, yeah.
Because wasn't it it was a...
The tannoy, yeah.
That they were using, tiny little speakers.
And
they would have had their 30-watt amps or whatever they were. I don't know, I'm sure they had louder than that, but...
But even so, I mean, no monitor speakers and fallback and that kind of stuff. That's always astonishing to me, that they're somehow managing to get those harmonies right-ish.
Yeah.
Just from what they can pick up from their own guitar amps.
Yeah, yeah.
They couldn't hear each other, could barely hear Ringo. It's amazing. And just as well with Shea Stadium, when you see... Because the kind of staging of a stadium gig, people have perfected. We know how to put on a gig in a stadium these days. They didn't know how to do it then. They didn't want people on the grass. You've just got them there on this little stage that they have to take a car out, you know, to get to. It's baffling, isn't it?
You know, been just done before.
How far away from the audience they are.
I once had a girl, or should I say, she once had me. She showed me her room, isn't it good, Norwegian wood.
Now here's a huge jump. We're back in the studio. This bird has flown,
yes,
as it was known at the time. And this is take one.
Yeah, and actually here's something I'm surprised. So I'd not listened to this for a while. And in my memory, it was just like far too much sitar. And part of their process was just, you know, that good taste again, knowing don't overplay your hand. But actually, it's pretty reasonable. It's not like, oh, we've got a sitar, let's cover the track in it.
Yeah.
There's more than there is on the finished thing, I think. But, I mean, it's a brilliant song. I just think, like, if you owned a little music shop, what a boon it must have been for you the second the Beatles started using that sitar.
Yeah. Like, by hundreds.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it must have done more for the sitar industry than anything before or since.
Yeah.
But it's less different than I remember it being to the finish.
There is another take that was doing the rounds as well. I think it was take two, tons of sitar on.
Right.
So they would have done that after this. So maybe they're thinking, yeah, we need some more. We've got this sitar. Let's whack it, pile it on.
It's also... The thing that surprises me about the sitar, on in as much as it's used on Beatles records, is George was a novice, and yet it still sounds good.
Yes.
It doesn't sound like somebody who's seen a piano for the first time and is just like picking out a tune one-fingered. So I'm guessing if you are like a virtuoso sitar player, what he is doing is very, you know, you can hear that it's very basic, but it's very basic and yet perfect for the song as well.
Yeah. There was an interview with Brian Matthew. They were talking about Revolver. And Brian Matthew was asking John and Paul, oh, you won't be using a sitar on this, will you? Everybody's doing that now. And they're like, oh, yeah. Love you too. Yeah, we are big time going to be using
it. Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, but they were, you know, the Stones, the Yardbirds. It was everywhere.
Yeah,
yeah. In 67, it was just, as you say, that guy in that little shop.
And all because George saw one hanging around on the set of Help. I'm looking through you, where did you go? I thought I knew you, what did I know? You don't look different, but you have changed. I'm looking.
Another great version, I'm Looking Through You.
Yeah.
He hadn't quite written the why, tell me why section yet.
Yeah, I like the bit at the end. That bit's good at the end, isn't it? Yeah. And is it Matchbox? Is Ringo shaking a Matchbox?
Yeah.
I mean, I just, as you said before, this is the thing about this particular stage of the anthology is just getting to an idea of the phases the songs went through before they became what they became. And the stops on the way for me are really interesting, but they never did it better than the finished versions.
Yeah. Paul's vocal as well. Just beautiful. Tell me about when you interviewed Paul.
So I've interviewed him a lot of times, actually. Probably like 15 or 16 times. Wow. And the first time was in 1999 for Run Devil Run.
Oh, great album.
Now, up until that point, the closest I got to a Beatle is I was a runner on the Mrs. Merton show. I'd been fired off the radio. I used to work with Caroline Ahern and Craig Cash. Ooh. And they took pity on me and they gave me a job on the Mrs. Merton show. Buying Benson and Hedges and Asti Spumanti for Caroline, just making sure that she'd had just the right amount of Asti Spumanti before she let rip. And that for some reason, in the green room after an episode of the Mrs. Merton show, Mike McGeer was there, Paul's brother.
Yeah.
And I could not believe it. Me and my best friend from Manchester, Chris, who's as big a Beatles fan as I am, we got to talk to Mike McGeer and were like watching his eye and like watching his mouth for McCartney mannerism.
Oh, wow.
I remember coming away that night and thinking, that's amazing. I mean, that's going to be my thing. I'm one step away from a Beatles.
Yes.
And then I moved to London. I started working for Virgin Radio and I was invited to a playback in the old Empire Cinema, I think, in Leicester Square, of Run Devil Run. And, you know, the rumour was McCartney was going to be there. But the trouble was this playback was at the same time as I was on the air.
Oh,
and it was me and this other guy at the time, Pete. We used to be in a double act. So I said, what if we sort of put the links on tape? It's only 5 minutes around the corner. We were in Golden Square in Soho.
Yeah.
And it was quite a wild time to be at Virgin Radio. Chris Evans owned it. It was the end of the millennium, and it was sort of quite a wild place to work.
Yeah.
I've not had a drink now for 18 years, but I was just sort of drunk all the time back then, on and off the air. So I didn't think it'd be that bad, really, to put the links on tape, pay somebody 10 quid to sit there playing them out, and we would just nip round to this venue around the corner and hear Run Devil Run. The rumour was McCartney was going to be there. So we do this and we go round there. And as I'm on the way in, I get accosted by somebody I know. So I end up talking to somebody for 5 minutes. In the distance, I can see Pete, and he's sort of mingling with a few other people, and I can see Paul McCartney working his way around. And he's talking to Pete. I'm thinking, this isn't fair. He's not the Beatles fan. I'm the Beatles fan. He's talking to Paul McCartney and I'm missing out on this. So I bolt over, and just as Paul McCartney's like finishing this conversation with Pete, and I grab his hand and go, oh, it was nice to meet you. Like I'd been in the conversation. And I thought, well, there we go. I've touched a Beatle, and that, you know, that will do for me. And then a few days later, we got a phone call from a guy called Jeff Baker, who used to be Paul's right-hand man. He's a lovely, lovely man. I think, you know, a protege of Derek Taylor in some ways, and it shows. And he said, do you want to come and interview Paul? Like, yeah, of course. He says, well, you need to be at his office in Soho Square this afternoon.
Wow.
And it was this weird day because I was a little, again, it's, you know, my alcoholism sort of plays into it, but I was a little bit drunk already and I went to leave the house and I couldn't get out because I'd left my keys in the door from the night before getting home drunk. So I had to ring somebody from the radio station to send a lad round to come and let me out of my house. So I sort of turned up to Paul McCartney's office in you know, a bit of a chaotic state, really. And then, you know, you go in and there's the artwork from Tug of War. Is the painting up on the wall in reception, and the carpet is specially made woven MPL carpet with notes on it, and you know, we get shown up to this ante room outside his office, and then say, okay, do you want to go in? So we go into his office. I think he's going to be there. He's not. So we're just sitting in his office, looking at his jukebox and looking at the invaluable paintings that he's got on the walls.
Yeah.
And then I hear him and he's just walking in singing. And this has blown my mind. I'm thinking, Paul McCartney's just walked in the room and he's singing. And he comes in and he's just great. And, you know, because I've seen him interviewed so many times, I know, and it goes back to that thing I was talking about before, that he has this thing where I think he's very careful to keep a part of himself for himself. And one of the ways in which he does that is if he's got anything to promote, he's got his stories, he's got his take, and he will make you feel like you're the only person he's ever told it to.
Yeah.
But you know, if you then listen back to all the promo interviews, everybody's getting the same interview. So the thing that had been in my mind is, how do we not get that interview? And it's sort of like a bit wacky at the time, but we got him sort of like, we took that day's copy of the Sun newspaper and got him second guessing the Dear Deirdre answers. and he really liked it. He really liked, because I think, you know, if you do anything too wacky, sometimes people don't like it.
You don't
but I think he enjoyed being engaged, and over the years I've always tried to do different things with him, and I think that's why he's kept coming back. But in that first interview, I remember, like, one of my questions that I loved was like, what's best, the first note of A Hard Day's Night or the last note of She Loves You? And you know, straight away, you know, you see him think, yes, first note of Hard Day's Night, and he's right. But you know, so it's but you know, I just interviewed him a lot over the years. When he would come to the radio station, do it in the studio, those were always my favourite ones. Although, you know, the great memory I have is I turned 30 in 2003. I'd been away with all my friends for the weekend, and I came back and I was seeing him play at Earl's Court on the Monday or the Tuesday night. And Jeff Baker again, I think, at the time, called up and said, oh, do you want to interview Paul before the gig? And so I went to interview him, and it, you know, we will have all seen those interviews he does on tour where it's draped with Moroccan curtains and lamps and things. And, you know, he's got self-awareness about it. Yeah, you know, he understands that there's something like ridiculous about it. But knowing that I was seeing him that night, I said, Paul, I bet you £5 you won't do a particular thing for me. And he wouldn't take my money for the bet, but he says, you just wait. So I go to the concert that night, and he opens, with Hello Goodbye. The second song is Jet. This is where the little bet that I made with him came in. And for the first three Jets on the song Jet, he sang Jeff.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was the great moment for me.
Oh, I'm never going to be able to hear that song again in the same way.
Yeah. He's just wonder. I mean, I just find him to be wonderful. He's done some, you know, just lovely things. Like, he sent a message when I got married. He sent a message when I left the radio station with a little sort of thing for my son, who was a baby at the time. I think, you know, I just really like it. It was such a relief, really. They say never meet your heroes. Yeah. And I'm sure Paul can be difficult. I'm sure if you work for him and something doesn't go right, I'm sure if everything has been done according to your whims since you were 20, I don't think that doesn't affect your personality. Yeah. But I think it's really important to him, in as much as he can, is to try and not let it affect him. And you know, I think it's inevitable that it does. I think different people have different experiences, but in my experience, he would just always make the loveliest effort. If he was in the lift with somebody from the sales department coming up to the studio, or the receptionist, one time he did something which, you know, I thought was a bit of an ask, but he did it anyway. You know, they could all do each other's signatures.
Yes.
When I got together with my wife, my now mother-in-law told me her favorite Beatle was Ringo.
Yeah.
So I got an 8x10 black and white picture of Ringo, and then got Paul to sign it as Ringo.
Was that any good?
It was pretty good. Yeah. And I just think, you know, he's just really, really game. And, you know, he knows that when people meet him in the least obnoxious way, that it's going to be an event in their life. And I think he's really conscious most of the time in making that a special event for people.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, having been lucky enough to interview him a few times, I think he really likes to just sort of chat and connect on a personal level as well. You know, he'll like asking me about my sod or the wedding, or, you know, spending some time in New York as we talk about what shows to see, or what, you know, whatever it is. Yeah. I mean, these are it's a weird thing talking about conversations that would just be small talk with anybody else, and I'm remembering them because it was small talk before McCartney. But I just think I've interviewed so many people who don't feel that need, or don't have that level of ability to connect with another person anymore who isn't mega famous.
Yeah.
And I just think it's important to him, and I think it just reflects so well on him as a person.
Yeah. It's interesting, Matt Everett mentioned that.
Yeah.
He was saying about, if he's telling you a story about John, he knows that you're going to be thinking, Paul McCartney, and he'll gently tell you, you know, he knows how big this is going to be for you.
Yeah.
It's very kind of, it's just John.
But somebody could tell you about that, and it could sound really conceited, but it isn't conceited with him. This is the thing, and I don't think he's an angel. As I say, I think different people have different experiences, but most people I've ever talked to just have had this very positive experience with him that I think just reflects really well on him as a person, and probably speaks to his upbringing and him understanding what it is to be a fan, and also just him trying where possible to not let it go to his head. But how could it not in some other ways as well?
Original. This kind of ends this period of the Mop Top era.
Yeah.
And you can hear it. They desperately need to try something different.
I'll tell you what gets me about this particular piece of music is that Revolver is one of the greatest albums of all time and one of the most revered of all Beatles albums. When they're making it, they're so up against it and the cupboard is so bare that they think, oh, should we do an instrumental just in case we haven't got enough songs to fill it? And then they end up pulling these songs at the last minute out of the bag. I can't remember what the last songs to be recorded for Rubber Soul were. But that's amazing to me that Rubber Soul is this brilliant piece of work. It is possibly them at their peak as a band in a certain way. I mean that specifically as a group. I think, you know, Revolver has more songs of even better quality than Rubber Soul, but that start of him starting to be a Beatle and his backing band starts to kick in, but that doesn't really seem to be a thing on Rubber Soul, and it's this brilliant perfect album, and yet, you know, when you dig into it, they were throwing it together and thinking, shit, we've not got enough music to fill an album. That's astonishing, right?
Yeah they were always interview with John when they were releasing, I think it was I Feel Fine, and he was genuinely terrified about it not getting to number one. They'd hit this peak, and every time they released a single, it was a big kind of, what if it doesn't get to number one? And with hindsight,
but pop music, you know, you have the mentality they would have had looking at everything that had gone before is you've only got a couple of years and then it's all over. You know, when they talk about opening hairdressers and, you know, or writing musicals, they've got one eye on that. I mean, it is bizarre with hindsight, but at the time it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
If One Direction, for example, were worrying about the hits drying up, you'd probably think, yeah, you're right to be worried, you know. And they might have been thinking of themselves at the time, because according to the precedent of what had gone before.
So it was another 5 months before the Beatles returned to the studio. Tomorrow Never Knows was quite a start to the new album.
It's unbelievable to think that's the start, because it really signposts where they're heading.
Yeah.
But that's the start to Revolver. I remember playing the finished version on the radio like 2 or 3 years ago, and somebody texting in thinking it was a new record and asking whether. I think, you know, the Beatles records are timeless in this way, and, you know, this peak really of pop culture. But I do think generally you'd be able to age them if you'd never heard them before. You'd be able to say, oh, that belongs in this era.
Yeah.
But Tomorrow Never Knows, it just sounds like nothing else.
Even on this, I mean, this is take one, which they call Mark One, but it's different, but it's still based on this tape loop, this...
Yeah, yeah.
And Ringo, he goes out of sync quite early on it, but would that have ever happened before, anybody playing along to a live tape loop?
I mean, part of the thing with the Beatles is if they were into something and you read about it, or they were influenced by something, then you tend to go and investigate it. I think that, you know, that's probably how I ended up buying Bob Dylan records. Mm. That being said, I have never sort of gone and investigated any Stockhausen or any of the mid-60s tape loop stuff that McCartney was going and experiencing in swinging London with Jane Asher.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I don't know that when these happenings and performances of this kind of avant-garde... Was it George Harrison who called it Avant-Garde a Clue?
Yeah, yeah.
he's such an old man in these ways.
He's always... Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if, you know, maybe these loops were being played live and then orchestras or, you know, musicians be playing along with them. But certainly in terms of a studio, and then you hear of these tape loops winding around broom handles and things.
It's bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because this one, it only seems to be one tape loop that they're playing, and then Ringo's playing along with it.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, maybe they heard this, and then they think, well, why have one tape loop when we can have... And they did all these seagull noises.
Yeah.
There's a great thing on, I think it's on YouTube, where you can hear the source recordings of all of the tape loops.
Oh, fascinating.
And especially the seagull one. It's sped up, and I think it's played backwards, but it's someone sort of going... literally, I think it's Paul McCartney.
Oh, well, whichever blessed soul did that for us deserves an OBE. Yeah, yeah. That's what I'll be doing straight after we finish this. You know, obviously the vocal becomes this whole other thing as Lennon becomes obsessive, and there are the stories of him wanting it to sound like 1,000 chanting Tibetan monks and being suspended from the ceiling and so on. But, you know, based on the evidence... here on take one, it didn't change that dramatically.
I need your love, I need your love, I need your love, I need your love into my life. Or somehow, some way.
Got to get you into my life. And this is a completely different version.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
This presumably was like the idea of how the song should sound. Mm. And then they go away and think, no, actually, it needs to be more Motown-y or whatever's going on with the brass on there.
Yeah.
Because you hear the finished version and you would assume that's how it was conceived.
Yeah.
And it isn't. And, I love any of these things, really, where you hear that clarity of Paul's vocal. That's some of the anthology stuff is great for this. Because what a musical instrument in its own right that voice is. And just mind-blowing that two of the great voices of the 20th century happened to be in the same band. Yeah. Like, how did that happen? How? Like, it'd be inconceivable that, I don't know, Nina Simone and Etta James just happened to grow up a few streets away and form a band. You know, it's... Yeah.
And two voices that work so well together, complement each other as well.
And they why do they? I mean, they're so different, really, and yet they glue together. And then you've got George's in there too, which is a great vote. I mean, it's not comparable in the same way, but what George brings vocally to the band, it's too much. It's too much to bear.
It's lovely to hear their backing vocals as well on this.
Yeah, the kind of,
And there's a genuinely... exhilarating moment with that. I need your love.
Yes.
I need your love, which they didn't use on the final one, but whoa.
Yeah.
First time you hear that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny that they didn't use that, but I mean, I guess there was so much else going on by the time they got the brass section in.
Yeah.
tell me that you've got everything you want, and your bird can sing, but you don't get me. You don't get me. You can't see me.
And your bird can sing.
Oh, I mean, this was when this Anthology 2 CD came out. This was one of the ones that I just went to over and over again.
Yes.
Because you'd read in the you know, the recording sessions book that it had originally started as kind of a birds like track, and just hearing that is exciting. But
yeah.
Then I mean, it's like we were talking before about the chatter in the studio. Anything that gives you a glimpse into what chemistry existed between them beyond what's there in the music is just endlessly fascinating to me. That's why I think the Ron Howard 8 days a week thing was good. I didn't think it was brilliant. I don't think it was up there with a lot of sort of official Beatles things. But what was great about it was any time you got to see them just talking or dicking around at a press conference, and that interband dynamics are fascinating to me. And especially when you think how rough it got towards the end. I think you can overly romanticize these things as well, and you can want Lennon and McCartney to be in this friendship that borders on romance and be as close as brothers. And maybe brothers is a closer thing because it's a much more complicated relationship than that. And as you get older, you understand that things aren't always that perfect. I mean, it's funny. Did you hear Ron Howard? Maybe it was Paul talking about Ron Howard showing him footage and being surprised, think, oh, there's me and John, and we're having a nice moment. We really liked each other. It being surprising to him, that's beautiful to hear him talk about. Because, and again, you know, I think over the years, he has bought into, or it suits him best to sell that Beatles myth. But there's an interview with him, I think, on like one of the British morning TV shows, like Good Morning Britain TV AM, one of those things, maybe with Selena Scott, 81, 82-ish, not long after John has been shot. And the way he's talking about John, I mean, the grief is very present, but the way he's talking in that interview is very different to the way he talks about him now. Right. And, you know, you get the impression that John was this, as we know, this hard-skinned character who could be mean to Paul, and Paul's saying, I think, you know, he only ever sort of complimented me once. And it's very much in contrast with the way he talks now. It's like, oh, we'd have these special moments with guys who loved each other. I think to hear them laughing,
the giggling,
it's just beautiful to get these moments of their friendship. So you can see it sort of holistically rather than this thing that deteriorated.
John has got the best giggle ever. It's just awesome. But aside from that, then you've got this bouncing bass and this 12-string guitar. And it is perfectly, you know, you read the description, it's birds, like, wow, the Beatles sounding like the birds. And there it is.
It doesn't
let you down. It's there.
It's a brilliant thing. Are there any versions sort of in that style without the giggling? Because am I right in thinking this is some kind of composite, isn't it? Because there's a vocal and then there's the giggly vocal on top of it.
Yeah, there is you can do it.
Right.
You can do it. If you've got the right editing equipment, it is possible.
Yeah.
And it's still sounds great.
And another one of these songs, you know, mentioned, yes, it is earlier. What was John Lennon thinking of when he said it was a horror, a throwaway?
I know. There's a feel like that. I've got my theory that when he did the Jan Wenner interview, when he got together with Yoko, and he was trying to, I think he was trying to get rid of all these misogynist songs that he'd done in the past. And he was just listing off all these, oh, no, that was rubbish.
And do you think
rubbish.
Bird, because the double meaning of bird?
Could be. Because there was rumours it was about Marianne Faithfull.
Yeah.
But
I've never seen anything that's convinced me of that.
No,
really.
I'm not sure about that. That's the problem with John, isn't it? You read the interviews and then he says that. And then he'll say completely the opposite the next year.
Although, have you seen, you know, some a line Mark Lewisohn is going with at the moment is this is the received wisdom about John, but he doesn't buy into it. He thinks there's more consistency than you. This idea that John said one thing one day and another thing the next is perhaps something we want to believe rather than something that's actually true.
Yeah.
I mean, he was definitely faddish. I mean,
oh yeah,
but I don't know. I mean, that's the version I liked. I don't want to hear John Lennon saying George Martin made a mess of producing these records. I just want him to be in a bad mood. Yeah. I've said it, and then no, he didn't really mean it though.
What was the story? George Martin met John a few years before he died, and George was saying, "Why did you say all those things about me?" And John's response was, "Oh, I was high."
Right.
Okay.
Yeah,
so I think John just like you said, he was real. He was, he is what he is. Blurted it all out.
Yeah,
and there was so much,
ammunition
there.
Yes,
bless him. Don't ask me what I want it for. If you don't want to pay some more, Taxman. This is a slightly different version.
Only slightly, though. You see, you've got the anybody got a bit. Anybody, I can never do that. It's like a tongue twister for me. Yeah. I mean, how they managed to do it instead of the ha-ha Mr. Wilson and ha-ha Mr. Heath. So, you know, again, it was one of those things. I remember listening to this. Maybe I'd heard it on a bootleg. I can't remember. But the first time you hear it with something different in the middle is like really exciting. Yeah. Generally, you know, I've got a problem with anybody moaning about tax, and yet moaning old George, I'll forgive him forgive it for it. I just think it's an interesting thing about the Beatles, and I think it's closer to the surface with George, but it's there with all of them, that anybody taking anything that was theirs away from them or in some way being on the make from them really got their backs up. And you know, I know that exists to this day. I once met somebody who is a huge Beatles fan and in a position where he was close enough to, at various stages, each of the three surviving Beatles at that time to go out for dinner with them individually. And he said all of them, to a greater or lesser degree, you know, at some point in the evening, made barbed remarks about bad deals on their behalf. One of them particularly, sort of Brian Epstein, but just this idea that, I mean, they really had to fight for it, didn't they? Threw everything into it. It was them versus the world, and they did it, and they, you know, created this thing that the world went nuts for, and people staking ownership of it or taking stuff away from them really didn't sit well with them. And I think for that reason, George Harrison is the only person I can forgive for moaning about having to pay tax.
I wonder if, because a lot of their contemporaries at the time, so the Who, Small Faces especially, the Kinks especially, and they would have known, they all knew the Beatles, and they were all friends after, even, you know, even after the split up. And they were all utterly, utterly ripped off. And I'm wondering that that resentment is also not just for them, but for their contemporaries at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot, you know, these bands made nothing at all.
Yeah, it's astonishing, isn't it? And, you know, Brian Epstein had, he just loved them and I think had their best interests at heart. And it wasn't like he was this rube coming in and not knowing it was what he was doing. It's just, we hadn't, nothing like this had been seen before.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they were making it up as they went along because there weren't good precedents to follow.
I just had a horrible thought of Alan Klein managing the Beatles in 62. What would have happened? Oh, dear.
Yeah.
All sorts would have
They were
out.
Very lucky. I mean, most of the time it was the exact right person for them.
Next, we have Eleanor Ring. Eleanor Ringpiece. Next, Ellen Rigby, and it's the strings only version. Yeah. Sorry, I can't.
Sorry. You know, you've just ruined that song for everybody after more than 50 years of being one of the jewels in the Beatles' crown. Everybody's just going to hear Eleanor Rigby's now.
I saw an advert for Viz on the way here. I blame them. Anyway. So, but yeah, lovely to, you know, celebrate George Martin.
Yeah. You want to hear me singing along with this in my kitchen. It's really something quite magnificent.
Really.
It's interesting, isn't it? So George Martin did these faultless arrangements. I'm also sort of curious how much Paul's Durdering, which he would have had to do not being able to write music and not having the same kind of musical vocabulary as George Martin had, how much of it made it through into those arrangements. Mm. You know, in other words, like, how much of this is George Martin composition and how much is it George translating what Paul wants?
Yes. I think you could possibly gauge that from the White Album box set when they're doing Good Night. And then you can hear John, because he was doing his kind of Dear Prudence, Donovan picking. That was kind of the first version that they played for Ringo. And then you hear George Martin's version.
Yeah.
All he's got is the chords. And it's this beautiful piano, just rich classical music just pouring from his fingers.
But George Martin, so if you take all the instrumental stuff from Yellow Submarine, that isn't as good as the orchestrations he's doing for the Beatles.
Yeah.
So there's something going on, isn't there? There's some kind of control or collaboration going on from the Beatles' side, which, you know, helped hone those arrangements. I'll tell you what I do love thinking about is the Family Way from this era and the melodies Paul uses on that soundtrack. There's some beautiful melodies, and just thinking about songs that never were, if those melodies had ended up in Beatles songs.
Yeah.
You know, maybe For No One could be maybe the closest we get to that.
Yeah. And also, again, George Martin, he did the Radio 1 theme.
Yes, Theme 1.
Theme 1. If you listen to that, and then you listen to I Am the Walrus, there are a lot of sections in Theme 1 that he then, it's got lots of it.
So does Theme 1 predate I Am the Walrus? That is very interesting.
Yeah. I'm guessing with John's songs, I'm sure John was, do whatever you want.
Yeah,
but I think
Paul
would have been a bit more hands-on.
And
perhaps
then bitching about it in the 70s. Maybe if you paid more attention at the time.
Let me move on to the last of the Revolver songs. So, I'm Only Sleeping. There's a rehearsal and there's also Take One.
It's very trebly, that rehearsal take, isn't it? It's a bit tinny. I like the song. I like how lazy it ended up being on Revolver. And you can hear that the laziness maybe wasn't something that quite cracked here. Apart from on that instrumental version where it's too lazy, it sounds like sort of easy listening.
Well, it's sort of Brian Wilson-y Pet Sounds.
Oh, yes,
kind of
yes.
Feel,
yeah, I'd not made that link, actually. But that's exactly what it is.
I've got a theory. The acoustic version, they recorded after they'd finished the one that eventually appeared on Revolver. I'm wondering, possibly, because it's a very ragged acoustic version, were they possibly trying to emulate the Beach Boys' Party kind of sound that Barbara ran?
Oh.
Or possibly doing something for the Christmas record?
Oh, I...
why would they...
that is a strange one, because, you know, with all these things, it's progression, isn't it? It's very rare they get somewhere and then row backwards.
Yeah.
They get there and then it's done. That's fascinating. I'd never picked up on them.
Yeah.
So, I know maybe they'd have heard the Beach Boys Party because there's a version of I Should Have Known Better on there.
Yes,
I've never. And they'd be very sort of aware of what was going on with the Beach Boys, obviously. But I've never, I don't think, read anything that references that album. But I think that's a good theory. I love a good conspiracy theory.
Anybody has any ideas, go to I'm the Egg
Pod. What were they up to? What were they doing? Yeah! We'll
We come to the last couple of songs on disc one, Rock and Roll Music and She's a Woman from the Budokan.
The Budokan performances are just awful. I mean, is it Paperback Writer where the mic stand hasn't been tightened properly and it keeps moving away from Paul's mouth as he's singing?
Yeah.
And, you know, I was talking before about what a lovely man I've always found him to be. You would not have wanted to be either Neil or Mal when they came off stage after that.
Yeah.
Because you can see the temper that he is furious about that. And, you know, in contrast to the Blackpool tracks we talked about earlier, the harmonies are terrible. Is it Nowhere Man especially?
Yeah.
Oh, it's really flat. Back to the anthology, sort of looping back. I enjoy the bits where they're sitting round the table, I think at Friar Park, and they're trying to talk about the harmonies, and it just veers ever so slightly towards being Spinal Tap around Elvis's grave.
Yeah.
And there's a paperback.
Yeah.
And Paul's saying it's Nowhere Man, and George is going, no, I think it was Paperback Writer. Yeah.
Thank you so much for that. That's disc one. We're going to be doing disc two very soon.
Chris said to me, this is going to have to be a two-parter, and I thought, I've got nothing to say. I mean, I like the music and I've read the books, but I've got nothing to say. I mean, you'll struggle to fill one episode, but yes, we'll have to reconvene at some point.
We shall. Thank you so much, Jeff Lloyd. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. I've loved it. Thank you.